Hello and welcome to our program. I'm Baron James Delgado. I'll be reading from the summer 2026 issue of Discover here on Sight into Sound Radio. Story number one, SETI expands the search for alien signals. Have we been listening to the wrong radio channel? Discover why we focused on one small slice of the radio spectrum for decades and how new technology and strategies are expanding the search. A story by Jenny Lehman. Staring into the starry night sky convinces many of us that we can't be alone in this universe. So far, astronomers have been looking for alien signals in a specific part of the radio spectrum, which seemed the most likely frequency other intelligent life forms would want to communicate through. But now they're wondering, have we not heard from aliens yet because we were listening to the wrong channel all along? A new study, led by a researcher from the University of Manchester and presented at the Royal Astronomical Society's National Astronomy Meeting before being published as a paper, proposes expanding the search to higher radio frequencies for technological signals, radio signals that are unlikely to occur naturally and may instead indicate advanced technology from non-human civilizations. While initial trials exploring different, largely unexplored frequencies did not detect any signals in this study, future Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI, surveys may now investigate a broader stretch of the radio spectrum. Moreover, changing the strategy has also helped scientists better understand where they've already looked for signals and where to focus next. For decades, SETI searches have concentrated on a relatively small part of the radio spectrum. We wanted to ask what might happen if we looked somewhere very different, said astronomer Louisa Mason, a researcher at the University of Manchester, in a press statement. Water tells astronomers which radio frequencies to tune into. According to Britannica, natural radio sources, such as stars, gas clouds, and pulsars, typically emit radio waves across a broad range of frequencies, rather than one razor-thin channel. For SETI, astronomers are usually looking for signals that have properties nature rarely produces, like extremely narrow radio transmissions, signals concentrated at one precise frequency, or those that repeat in a deliberate way. But why radio in the first place? SETI says because radio waves come with several advantages compared to other forms of light, like gamma rays, X-rays, or infrared, they can be produced relatively easily, travel enormous distances, and pass through Earth's atmosphere. To narrow down the search, since the whole radio spectrum is enormous, most radio SETI surveys have focused on the water hole range, located between frequencies of 1.42 and 1.66 GHz. This relatively quiet part of the radio spectrum lies between the natural radio emissions of hydrogen and hydroxyl, whose combination forms water. Scientists made an educated guess that this region could serve as a natural meeting place because a technologically advanced civilization might recognize the importance of water and choose to communicate near those frequencies. Changing frequencies opens new territory in the search for alien signals. The Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, or ALMA, in Chile, wasn't built to look for aliens. Instead, it studies things like star formation, galaxies, dust clouds, and planets. Every time ALMA observes one of these objects, it records radio data. Mason realized those archived observations could also be searched for technosignatures rather than natural astrophysical processes. According to their website, ALMA was built to observe millimeter and submillimeter radio waves, which occupy a much higher part of the radio spectrum than the traditional water hole frequencies. The millimeter and submillimeter radio bands remain almost completely unexplored for SETI, so this is really about opening up a new area of parameter space to search, said Mason in the release. So far, Mason has analyzed only 4 archived ALMA observations without detecting any candidate technosignatures, but she emphasized how important this new approach could be for future SETI programs. Understanding where we've already looked and where to search next. Whenever a radio telescope points at one star, galaxy, or other target, it inevitably sees everything else within its field of view. The everything else, in this context, is also called stellar bycatch. Besides proposing to expand the search into other radio frequencies, Mason also argues we've been underestimating how many stars were included in previous SETI surveys. Instead of relying on existing star catalogs, she used the Besançon Galactic Model, a simulation of the Milky Way, to better estimate how much searching humanity has already done. Using this new approach, she increased the estimated number of stars, including in one previous SETI survey, from about 288,000 to more than 6 million. One of the most exciting things about this work is realizing that we've surveyed many more stars than initially thought, she said. Even a very small observation can contain a huge number and diversity of stars that we might never have intended to study. By combining high-frequency observations with galactic simulations, we can better understand exactly what we've searched and where we should look next. This concludes story number 1. Story number 2. While mapping a camping trip, man spots previously unknown 390-million-year-old meteorite impact crater in Quebec. Learn how a man discovered a 390-million-year-old meteorite impact crater in Quebec, Canada, while planning for a camping trip in 2024. The story by Stephanie Edwards. A camping trip often begins with a map, some hiking routes, and a few promising places to pitch a tent. For amateur astronomer Joël Laponte, however, planning a 2024 trip through northeastern Canada led to something far stranger, the discovery of a cosmic collision that occurred roughly 390 million years ago. According to CBC News, while examining the Côte-Nord region of Quebec on Google Maps, Lapointe noticed an enormous circular indentation surrounding Lake Marsal. Spanning approximately 15.5 miles, the ring stood out against the surrounding landscape. To Lapointe, it looked suspiciously like a meteorite impact crater. His hunch eventually reached planetary geologists, who made the difficult journey to investigate the site themselves. Their findings, which they'll present at the annual Congress of the Meteoritical Society, provided strong evidence that Lapointe had spotted a previously unidentified ancient impact crater hiding in plain sight. How a Google Maps discovery led scientists into the Quebec wilderness. Gordon Osinki, a planetary geology professor at Western University, regularly receives tips about possible craters through Impact Earth, his website dedicated to verified impact sites. Most of these reported discoveries don't survive scientific scrutiny. Circular geological features can form through volcanic activity, erosion, glaciation, and other processes unrelated to meteorites. But Lapointe's discovery looked promising enough to warrant a closer examination. In 2025, Osinki and his team embarked on a 5-day expedition to the remote site. Getting there proved almost as challenging as investigating the crater. According to the CBC, rugged, overgrown terrain prevented the team's float plane from reaching shore, forcing the researchers to wade over 160 feet through the water while carrying their own equipment. Once on land, they photographed the terrain and collected rock samples for analysis in laboratories in Canada and France. If upheld through the full scientific review process, the roughly 15.5-mile-wide structure would join only about 200 confirmed impact craters known worldwide. The crater lies on the traditional lands of the Innu, and researchers named it Uhakatik, in consultation with the Innu Council of Iquanichit. Shatter cones help confirm a 390-million-year-old impact. A round shape alone cannot prove that a meteorite struck the ground. Scientists need geological evidence showing that rocks experienced pressures and temperatures far beyond those produced by ordinary Earth processes. At Uhakatik, the researchers encountered large cliffs that appear to consist of impact melt rock, which forms when the heat of a collision melts part of the landscape. More decisive evidence arrived on the expedition's second day, when the team located shatter cones. Powerful shock waves created these distinctive cone-shaped features, which occur almost exclusively at meteorite impact sites and underground nuclear explosion sites. Laboratory analysis of rocks formed during the collision allowed the team to date the structure to approximately 390 million years ago. Other surprising discoveries made with Google Earth. Uhakatik is far from the first remarkable feature noticed by someone exploring satellite imagery. The CBC also reported on how Saskatchewan resident Lynn Hickox spotted Alberta, Canada's Badlands Guardian, while using Google Earth to search for the Royal Tyrrell Museum. The natural formation resembles a human head wearing a headdress, although thousands of years of erosion, rather than an ancient artist, created its appearance. In 2009, Jay Wilbur used Google Earth to locate Fairy Bridge in China's Guangxi province, according to the Natural Arch and Bride Society. The enormous natural formation is considered the world's longest known natural rock arch. Google Earth also revealed unusual polka dot patterns along the Grand Canyon's North Rim. Green Matters reported that researchers now suspect colonies of red harvester ants created the circles by altering the vegetation around thousands of nests. Together, these discoveries turn digital maps into more than navigational tools. Sometimes looking closely at an ordinary screen is enough to uncover something extraordinary beneath our feet. This concludes story number two. Story number three, a downed World War II plane may be buried in a Polish forest, and its crew might still be there. Learn how burned British ammunition and a copper tube could help identify the World War II aircraft that may have crashed in a Polish forest. A story by Anastasia Scott. A resident in Poland went into a coastal forest on the eastern side to gather blueberries. While picking them, he came across a hole someone had dug with aluminum fragments and burned ammunition scattered around it. He picked up one loose fragment and carried it into the underground city. The former secret Cold War military command center is now part of the Museum of Coastal Defense. According to the museum, its staff followed the fragment back into the forest and found dozens more pieces scattered across the ground. The debris may mark where an Allied aircraft crashed during World War II, though the plane itself still has no name. World War II aircraft wreckage carries British clues, reads this headline. Viktor Jezeseski of the Museum of Coastal Defense was the first to examine the fragment. The thin sheets of aluminum and the way they had been shaped and riveted looked like aircraft parts rather than ordinary scrap, he said in the museum's account published by the Polish aviation outlet Lapalota.pl. Museum staff believe the ammunition is .303 British, a caliber used in British Browning aircraft machine guns. That makes a British aircraft, or one flown by another Allied air force, more likely. After cleaning the recovered pieces, staff found a copper tube stamped T7. In technical records from Britain's Royal Air Force, T-7 refers to tubing used in aircraft fuel, oil, and other onboard systems. The tube ends in what appears to be an Avimo high-pressure connector, a fitting that joined tubes carrying liquids or gases under pressure inside British aircraft. Museum staff said the same type of connector appeared in the cooling systems of Rolls-Royce Merlin engines. The connector cannot identify the plane on its own. Merlin engines powered several aircraft, including the Spitfire, Lancaster, and Mosquito. A Lancaster wing recovered in 2009 may be connected. The museum already holds a roughly 16-foot section of an Avro Lancaster wing that fishermen pulled from the Baltic Sea in 2009, roughly 0.6 miles from the new site. A museum director said the two finds may come from the same aircraft, according to the Polish Press Agency, or PAP, P-A-P. The researcher said they identified the earlier wing and found the names of three crew members connected with the aircraft. The airmen had flown over while traveling to bomb industrial targets near Bolis. Allied aircraft regularly crossed the region during the final months of WW2. Certain cities held a base operated by Germany's Navy and guarded by coastal guns and anti-aircraft defenses. The researcher said the ground around the new site rises and dips in an unnatural way. A larger piece of wreckage is still lodged in the soil, leading him to believe the aircraft's main body may have crashed at the site. The forest may still hold the aircraft's crew. If the main wreckage remains beneath the forest floor, the site could also be a grave. The engineers and the researchers say the crew may still be buried with the aircraft. The museum has contacted officials responsible for the forest, the historic sites, and military graves, according to PAP. The museum has not marked the location and has warned people against digging or taking fragments as souvenirs. No excavation date has been announced. Until archaeologists investigate, no one knows how much of the aircraft survives, whether its crew remains inside, or whether the debris matches the Lancaster wing pulled from the Baltic Sea 17 years ago. This concludes story number 3. You're listening to Baron James Delgado on Sight Into Sound Radio. You could listen to Sight Into Sound on HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone as well as your smart speaker. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. Now we resume with the summer 2026 issue of Discover and story number 4, Gravitational Tug of War turns up the heat on Jupiter's moon Io, causing underground temperatures to soar. Discover how Jupiter's gravitational pull impacts its moon Io, producing strong underground heat that powers hundreds of volcanoes. The story by Jack Knutson. Things are always heating up on Jupiter's moon Io, a volcanic-covered world that's constantly pushed and pulled by its host planet's gravity. NASA's ongoing Juno mission, while investigating the rocky moon, saw sweltering temperatures in its depths. With this unprecedented view, astronomers are now wondering what's causing so much heat to rise from the moon's subsurface. Previously, heat signatures from Io could only be seen escaping at its surface or through volcanic eruptions. But thanks to Juno's observations, researchers have been able to finally catch underground heat coming up to the surface, as explained in a new study published in the Journal of Geophysical Research, Planets. The process that generates this heat, called tidal heating, could provide insight into other moons across the outer solar system. Io provides a unique window into learning how tidal heating works throughout the cosmos, a fundamental process that provides energy and heat to worlds that are far from their parent star, said study co-author Scott Bolton, Juno's principal investigator at the Southwest Research Institute, in a statement. A heated tug-of-war with Jupiter. LO is one of the Galilean satellites, Jupiter's four largest moons, but it stands apart for how volcanically active it is, with over 400 volcanoes rising from its surface. So where did all these volcanoes come from? The answer lies in tidal heating, which the University of California Museum of Paleontology defines as the repeated deformation of a body, such as a moon, due to tides from another body, such as a planet, causing the heating of the former's interior. I guess it should be deformation. Or deformation? Deformation. Nevertheless, tidal forces from our own moon heat Earth's interior, but the effect is very minor. Looking at it the other way around, tides on the moon created by Earth's gravity cause the lunar crust to rise and fall, according to Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. In the case of LO, though, tidal heating has a much more drastic effect. The moon is often described as being in a tug-of-war with Jupiter, meaning it's always stretched and squashed by the gas giant's gravity as it proceeds on its slightly elliptical orbit. This tug-of-war powers LO's volcanoes, yet astronomers have never seen how the heat arises from below the surface. Surveys below LO's surface. NASA's Juno spacecraft, launched in 2011 to study Jupiter and its moons, has finally provided a view of the subsurface heat. The spacecraft's microwave radiometer, or MWR, with six microwave antennas that are able to detect microwaves at a wide range of wavelengths, was able to look deeper into it along with two of Jupiter's other Galilean moons, the ocean-bearing Europa and Ganymede. During flybys in December 2023 and February 2024, the instrument measured the moon's thermal emission at depths ranging from a few inches down to tens of feet, recording temperatures rising by 40 degrees Fahrenheit only a few feet into the surface. The heat may either be rising steadily through a conductive crust, or it could be coming from cooling lava flows that are capped by 30 to 35 feet of solidified crust. This heat output, scaled to the entire moon, represents a release of energy up to 30 times Earth's average. The details learned from studying this tidal heating, according to the researchers, could even be applicable to Earth's volcanoes. The surprising discovery that we could see below a rocky moon's surface has important implications for studying Earth's volcanoes. Juno has taught us that if we look with an MWR-type instrument near a volcano on Earth, we might see a similar signature in the subsurface temperature gradient, providing new information on how terrestrial volcanoes work, said Bolton. Smoother than it seems. In a separate finding using the MWR instrument, Juno observed a surprising smoothness to the surface. While the moon does have plenty of tall mountains, Juno's data has shown that the surface is also rife with another sort of smooth patch network that stretches for 60 miles or more. Away from its mountains, the surface is more like the Great Plains of North America. And even though it's a rocky body, the surface material has a very low density, more like pumice or a fluffy volcanic ash than solid rock, said lead author Shannon Brown, a scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And that concludes story number four. Story number five. A medieval hunter may have turned a 220-pound wild boar's tusk into a lucky charm. Discover how an engraved boar tusk from medieval Novgorod combined elite hunting, silver imitation, and an enduring belief in animal power. The story by Anastasia Scott. Killing a mature wild boar was dangerous enough that a 19th century Belarusian saying advised hunters to send for priest first. The boar behind one particular medieval trophy made that advice worthless thing to. It was at least 8 years old, weighed more than 100 kilograms or 220 pounds, and had researched the full size and strength. Oh, I'm sorry, and had reached the full size and strength. Archaeologists excavating the Troitsky 16 site in Veliky Novgorod, Russia, recovered one of the animal's tusks in 2020, fitted into an engraved metal mount designed to look like silver. Dated to the second half of the 12th or early 13th century, the find is described in the Volga River region archaeology as the first amulet of its kind ever recorded, a tooth or tusk set into a decorative mount. Medieval boar tusk amulet from Novgorod was made to resemble silver. Animal tooth and claw amulets are common finds in Novgorod, in the medieval layers, and boar tusks are the second most frequent type, behind bear teeth and claws. Of the 61 boar amulets recorded so far, 45 came from male tusks. Nearly all were drilled through and strung on a cord, but someone paid a jeweler to encase this one in metal and engrave it with flowing plant motifs and spirals, decorative work never before documented on a Novgorod 10 object. Chemical analysis showed that the mount was made from tin mixed with small amounts of lead and copper, a composition similar to what a 14th century London jeweler's guild classified as fine pewter. Its smooth and silvery surface likely made it an appealing substitute for the precious metal. The mount was likely cast in a two-part clay mold, then engraved by hand once the metal cooled. A separate strip of wire, made from a slightly different, lower-melting alloy, was smoldered around the wider end, showing the craftsman purposefully chose different metals for different parts of the job. Tin wasn't cheap or local either, most of it reaching Novgorod's jewelers likely traveled from tin mining regions in Britain, since usable tin deposits were scarcer across medieval Europe than copper or lead. The dangerous hunt behind an elite trophy. The tusk turned up on a wealthy estate alongside arrowheads, part of a saber's cross piece, a chainmail fragment, birch bark documents, and seal fragments, the kind of assemblage researchers associate with families tied to Novgorod's warrior elite. Nearby in the same layers sat a fragment of an equally rare tin pen decorated with a peacock. In medieval Rus', boar hunting was primarily a dangerous pursuit for princes, nobles, and warriors rather than a way to secure food or fur. A medieval chronicle records Prince Daniel of Galicia and his hunting party killing 6 boars during one outing, 3 of which the prince brought down himself with a spear. An older amulet tradition takes on a new meaning. Boar tusk amulets, like the swan that's seen on this page, were more common in Novgorod centuries earlier, peaking between the mid-900s and mid-1000s, a period researchers tentatively connect to close contact with Scandinavian culture and its boar mythology, including a golden boar sacred to the god Freya and boar-crested helmets found in warriors' graves across northern Europe. By the time this tusk was mounted, researchers believe that original meaning had faded roughly 150 years earlier. They argue that the tusk may instead have represented a hunter's strength and courage, transferred from animal to victor, while also serving as a charm for future good luck. A similar tusk found at another Rus town carries a scratched Christian inscription asking for divine help, suggesting that this old pagan practice had learned to coexist with newer prayers. The mount has no loop for a cord, but the tusk's broken end may once have carried another attachment. Whether worn, kept within the household, or passed down as an heirloom, its story may have remained worth telling for at least one more generation. And this concludes story number 5. We've also come to the end of our program. I've been reading from the summer 2026 issue of Discover. I'm Baron James Delgado, and this is a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas. Until next time.